Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, Director of Editorial for CityWire USA, and back in the hot seat this week after a whole week away where I left my my throne unattended and it was swiftly usurped by the almost ever-present Ian Wenig. But great job last week, Ian, I thought.
Yeah, it was kind of like that failed coup in Turkey back when I was in grad school that lasted for like 2 hours. And then we just pretend like nothing happened after.
Yeah, I don't like that comparison because it makes me sound like some sort of autocrat, both, you know, in this podcast and otherwise, which, you know, is wildly unfair. I was where was I last week? Oh, I was in Los Angeles for our professional buyer investor conference. And you obviously had Steve or Steven?
Steve
Levitt.
You can go by either, though.
Okay, yeah. As you described him, I think, very accurately, the most prolific RIA banker in the biz, giving a really good inside track about how those deals get done and what that landscape looks like. And I thought it was a great interview and a great episode. So no usurping, just good podcasting.
I appreciate that. It was a good interview.
Fantastic. And we are joined today by a special guest, not an external guest, we should add, but back from a brief hiatus, I'd say, away from the pod, Sam Bojarski, senior reporter at CityWire. Sam, fantastic to have you in the studio today.
Yeah, good to be back. Yeah, been a bit of a hiatus between, you know, kind of not feeling well and then in the travel and what have you. But yeah, great to be back on.
And before we get into the news, and there is a lot of it to discuss, Sam, you are, as this goes out, days away from the New York Marathon.
Days away, yeah. That's the plan. That's the plan, is to run the New York City Marathon on Sunday.
How are you feeling about it?
Feeling okay. Yeah. Yeah. Doing 50 mile weeks or so for a while. So that's
50 mile. I don't know if I've ever run 50 miles in my entire life. Excellent. Well, look, best of luck to you. It goes past the end of my road. So for convenience and because I do genuinely want to support you, I will do my very best to cheer you on. I think every time I've tried to see someone running it, I've missed them because the tracker thing's a little off. But oh, yeah. I know you're. We won't talk times, but I know you're.
You got to get there early.
Yeah. No, we will.
I got to stake out a spot.
Sure. Absolutely. We're looking forward to that. Best of luck, Sam. Let's fire the starting gun on the pod in earnest by getting in to some of the biggest news stories of the week. There we go. We got there in the end. Sam, big story this week. It's all about Stifel and Raymond James, or not about Raymond James, as the case may be. The basic story is that there were rumors and indeed a report that there might be some sort of action between the two firms, but the CEO of Stifel has come out and said that is not the case. There's quite a lot to unpack here, so maybe before we get to the denial, what's the thing that he was denying?
Yeah, so ever since Stifel has been talking about selling their hybrid RIA division, they formally announced that on Monday, that sale, but there was some coverage of it before. You know, there's kind of been some speculation around the industry about, you know, are they getting rid of a, you know, small, unprofitable division, you know, as preparation for a larger sale. And there's some other factors there that could lead someone to, you know, to think that they might want to sell the business. Folks have been talking and, Ray J's kind of been named as a potential suitor to purchase Stifel. And there was some coverage of that this week in another trade journal, Wealth Management. They had a story about a potential Ray J sale, or at least floating that possibility.
Okay, yeah. So that's the gist of it. So it's Stifel Independent Advisors, which is this sort of smaller hybrid division, which is about 5% of its overall sort of advisor network. So very much a sort of, I suppose, non-core part of the business that was sold to
1099 business. Most of their business is W-2.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was sold to Equitable Advisors and that was announced that the sale was going to happen a little bit ago. And ever since then, rumors began to circulate that maybe the wider business, Stifel Financial Inc., which is a publicly listed company, we should say, was, you know, that might, I guess, be bought by another company or go private or something. And then in the last, let's say, week or so, if I have this right, maybe the name Raymond James kept coming up. And you had heard this from various sources. But I suppose not to the degree that we felt that we could necessarily put something out there.
Yeah, there were sources, you know, sources in the investment banking community, recruiters, people like that, who were hearing, you know,
hearing this,
this talk about a potential deal with Raymond James.
And we'll get into it a little bit more in a moment, but I suppose the strategic logic for that looked like it made sense in that they are similar businesses. And Raymond James, we think, or had heard, would have been acquisitive for having missed out on a previous deal earlier this year.
Yep. Our sources have told us that they placed a bid to acquire Commonwealth Financial Network, the independent broker-dealer that LPL has acquired this year. So there was that, you know, maybe, you know, the thought was like, you know, maybe they were looking for another acquisition target after that fell through. And really, yeah, I mean, like the anatomy, if you will, of the two businesses, Raymond James and Stifel, are quite similar. They both have, you know, a brokerage business, traditional banking, and, you know, the like capital markets, investment banking divisions. So they would kind of fit together quite nicely.
Lots of overlap there. Okay, although this is not particularly important, we did discover via the internet that back in 1992, there were indeed talks between these two firms, and they came close to doing a deal that was then pulled off. Pulled rather than pulled off, I suppose. Pulling it off means you do it. Pulling it means you don't do it. Okay, so let's come back to this then. So credit here, I think, should go to wealthmanagement.com. Because they did get a story out on this, which effectively they had some good sourcing around, at least internally at Raymond James, they had discussed an acquisition for Stifel. I suppose what they hedged, very understandably, was whether, you know, how formal any talks might have been between these two firms and whether anything was imminent. I would say they sort of didn't go as far as to say that was the case, which is perhaps, you know, completely fair enough and quite fair reporting, I think. But Stifel's CEO, whose name you can say out loud because I won't get it right.
I believe it's Krzyzewski.
Okay, Ron Krzyzewski. He didn't like this reporting, and he came out with a slightly sort of, I suppose, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but sort of punchy statement, really. And that's what our story is, I suppose, which is him sending this memo, internally, we should say. He didn't send this out to sort of the media or anything. Just really pouring cold water on the idea that Raymond James was going to buy Stifel.
Yeah. There was an internal memo that we got a hold of. He just said, you know, in no unclear terms that the business is not being sold to Raymond James. We're number one, you know, we're going to invest in this business. We have a good culture. He's happy with how things are.
Okay. So. And yeah, but within that, let's dig into that a little bit, though. So he is saying that, and I think all journalists to some degree, you know, when you have a story, Ian, you know this probably as well as anyone, you have a story, you get some good sourcing. I should also say, this is, I'm going to stick up for journalists for a moment here. You know, when people pour cold water on, like, oh, they've got unnamed sources, like somehow that damages the credibility of the story. It doesn't. An unnamed source is a very, very good source. There's a reason why they're protecting their name. It's probably because they are in a position to know something and they shouldn't be saying something. And I think it's such an easy way out of things. Go, oh, well, the source is unnamed. It's like, that doesn't suddenly mean it's not credible. Anyway.
There are plenty of people who have decried the use of anonymous sources while being an anonymous source themselves in a separate story.
Yes.
I mean, the story I always like to tell is, without naming any names, is that there was one incident I had where I had several very reliable sources tell me that a certain RIA was selling and had hired a specific investment banker to do so. And when I went to the CEO for comment.
Of the firm.
Of the selling firm.
You understood to be selling, yeah.
They aggressively denied it. And they accused not only my sources, but of the investment bank, of using leaks to pressure him into selling. And so I'd never had this stringent of a denial before when it had the investment banker name. So we held it, and it kind of got filed away. And then a couple of months later, it turns out that he had sold his firm. And was lying to me.
And used that investment banker?
And had used that investment banker. Was just straight up lying to me the whole time.
So then, look. Yeah, I guess we're not saying that's necessarily the case here, but we are saying, A, just because someone's used anonymous sourcing doesn't mean it's not accurate. And B, you know, don't be surprised, I suppose, in general, we should say, not necessarily specific to this story, but in general, if, you know, someone denying a deal is taking place, that later down the line, a deal may indeed sometimes, in some cases, take place.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Hit dogs holler is the phrase.
Yeah. And that's what we're hearing too, is that the firms had discussed a deal, you know, and, you know, there was never any denial from the CEO about discussions around a deal.
Yeah, just that it's not happening now.
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay, but let's take him his word and say that, that they're not going to be sold to Raymond James. And that seems like, you know, if we read that memo, that does seem to be the message that's coming through. There had been, I suppose, some circumstantial speculation, reporting, I'm not quite sure what the right phrase is there, as to why Stiefel might be looking for a deal. So we touched on, obviously, Raymond James having missed out on Commonwealth. So they, you know, perhaps had priced in some growth via M&A this year. So yeah, the idea of looking for another target would make sense. What beyond the fact that Stiefel had sold this sort of non-core business, what is some of the thinking as to why Stiefel might want to do a deal at all? If, again, you know, with the caveat that they're saying they don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the main reasons is they've kind of been in regulatory hot water over the last, you know, year or so. I think a little more than that. They've paid like around $194 million in fines to regulators like FINRA. Those regulators have basically accused them of misrepresenting a structured note strategy.
Okay, and this was...
That was all connected to one broker-dealer, this guy Chuck Roberts.
Okay, so not systemic to the whole company, but obviously a big bill to have been footing.
Yeah,
I'll be very candid here. I don't know enough about how this works. Is that enough? You know, is obviously those seem like eye-watering sums. You know, nearly 200 million there in sort of restitution and fines and things. Is that enough of a problem that you would look to find a new owner by itself? Does that push you to do a deal?
I mean, it's the ongoing risk too, right? Like there might be other claims. We had this happen. This actually predates us, but I mean, there was the Allen Stanford Ponzi scheme. And I think that Pershing has been dealing with claims associated with that for years and years and years. I mean, the Lehman bankruptcy is still working its way through Chapter 11 court.
Those are bigger things though than one broker, I would suppose. Again, look, I don't know if we know the answer to this. It was a more broad question as to whether there's an element of people putting sort of two and two together and getting a different outcome from that, sort of looking for sort of justification when there isn't one. But maybe that, as I say, I don't know enough about it. Maybe that is easily enough for you to say, actually, we do need to do some sort of deal here.
Possibly, yeah.
Okay. So look, the gist of it all is that rumors been circulating for a while, gathered pace in the last few weeks. Raymond James was the name in the frame. Wealthmanagement.com has some sort of good reporting around Raymond James, at least discussing it internally. Less clear sort of in totality whether talks, you know, had taken place or sort of how far along they were between the actual two firms. And Stiefel now coming out and saying, look, there's not a deal that's happening. This is just rumor. And, you know, everyone stop saying that Raymond James is going to buy us. Yeah, that's where we are. And what do we think happens next? A case of kind of watch this space a little bit as to whether it's, I suppose, whether Raymond James looks to buy someone else instead, and whether Stiefel looks to do something with someone else instead.
We'll have to keep our ears to the ground. But I mean, I would not be surprised still, you know, despite what we just reported, if a deal materializes.
Okay. Very interesting. I think would vehemently disagree, but maybe we'll get him on the pod next week to talk about it. Ron, if you're listening, feel like coming on the pod, we could set something up. Although I don't know if people want the same story 2 weeks in a row. We'll figure it out. Excellent. Ian, anything else to add on the story?
No, other than I'm excited to keep reporting on it.
Brilliant. All right. Well, look, from a deal that didn't take place to a I suppose a deal that might take place, or a bunch of money that's going to fuel a bunch of deals, I suppose. It's not a neat segue. Not on my game today.
You nailed it.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of you, but it's not true. Ian, we could talk about another story this week, and this is very much a Wenig special. This is about a big old fund that's been raised, $2 billion, in fact, which is going to be spent on further investing in, acquiring, merging RIAs. So what's the fund? Who's involved and what's it going to do?
Yeah, so we broke earlier this week that Carl Heckenberg's Constellation Wealth Capital, which is a relatively new serial minority investor in wealth managers, is in the process of raising $2 billion or so for its second fund. And it filed the documents for Fund 2 at the SEC earlier this month. And from everything that I've gathered, it sounds like they are moving fairly aggressively to get money in.
Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. Who is Carl Heckenberg? What's his kind of background before he was working at Constellation? And then what has Constellation done so far?
Yeah, so Carl Heckenberg's been an executive in the wealth management industry for a long time. He was at Merrill Lynch for a time, with Wells Fargo. He was at Charles Schwab. But what's most relevant for our listeners is that for a long time, he was the chief executive of Emigrant Partners and Fiduciary Network, which are RIA minority investing businesses owned by billionaire Howard Milstein. And Carl was the replacement to the Fiduciary Network founder, Mark Hurley, who was pushed out after a power struggle with Howard Milstein. That's a podcast in its own right. Carl Heckenberg spent about 5 years or so in the CEO seat there at Fiduciary Network, Emigrant Partners, invested in a bunch of different RIAs, sold off some, and then in 2023, he left to go solo, and he raised roughly $1 billion for the first flagship fund for Constellation Wealth Capital, which we can refer to going forward as CWC.
Okay. All right, so CWC, I would have gone for just Constellation.
We can do either.
Constellation maybe feels easier. Fewer acronyms to remember. Probably helps my aging brain. Okay, so who's he bought so far with that? So he raised $1 billion for the first fund. And what do we have any insight as to what he invested in, or yeah, some of what he's invested in?
He's invested in a bunch. He took a position in Lido Advisors, which recently sold a stake in itself to HPS, now part of BlackRock. He's invested in AlphaCore Wealth Advisory. He's invested in Merit Financial Advisors. He joined up with Allianz to invest in Alti Global, which we've talked about on this podcast before. So he has this track record. He's been investing in a lot of RIAs that have some sort of track record or sponsor backing.
Okay, so that's interesting, isn't it? So he's not been buying. Often, I suppose, when people start their own fund and they seem to be, maybe buying into the, let's say this is the $1 to $5 billion range. Maybe they're kind of coming in, giving them institutional backing for the first time, looking to grow those businesses. But he's not. He's buying into somewhat mature firms who've already maybe gone through at least one round, if not in some cases two rounds of sponsorship.
They're maturing businesses. He's not deploying capital into $1 to $2 billion firms.
Yeah. Okay, so big businesses, mature, quite. Yeah, okay, fine. Second fund then. So we assume he sort of basically spent the billion, invested.
Yeah,
that.
He's fully deployed.
Okay, so this is his second fund. Who, do we have any idea about who's investing in it?
We're still working through that. It's tough with some of these kind of LP things to figure out who's investing. I mean, I can say that, Carl's been backed in the past by the founders of Blue Owl Capital Management, the alternative investment manager. So Doug Ostrover and Mark Lipschultz, they have a minority stake in CWC through their joint family office, which is called Black Owl Capital Investment. So he has some brand names backing him already.
Okay, excellent. And so as you say at the moment, raising it at the moment with a view to obviously deploying, I guess, in 2026 or something. And again, you may not know the answer to this. It may not have been disclosed. No one might have told us. But we assume a similar strategy to the first one. So sort of middle to later stage, more mature, larger RIAs, global wealth management practices kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good baseline assumption to make.
Excellent. Okay. And does this tell us anything about where things are sort of, in the M&A space? There's obviously, I suppose it tells us there's still lots and lots of demand.
I agree. Yeah.
For, for this trade.
I mean, look how many people are trying to pile in. I mean, it's pretty impressive that you start a private equity firm from nothing, raise $1 billion, and then fully deploy that $1 billion in like a year and a half, and then you double the size of fund too. I mean, it just shows how much insanely intense demand there is from wealthy individuals, institutions. Everybody wants to get in on this party.
And this is maybe an unfair question because we definitely didn't prep it. Does it tell us, you know, is there anything to be worried about? We talked, I can't remember exactly when, but let's say in the last like 3 weeks, obviously we talked about the Edelman Financial Engines deal and that being halted because obviously really big firm, more mature, couple of rounds of investment from external investors, but then, you know, went to market and couldn't get the valuation that it wanted. If Carl and Constellation are playing in some of those more mature, larger firm spaces, is there any concern that he'll run into any of those kind of issues, or are these very different businesses to Edelman?
Well, answer that in two ways. I think first is, so as we've reported before, Alti is trying to do a take private sale. So we don't know whether that would mean that Carl would exit his position in that company or whether he'd roll his equity over. So, you know, that's a company that he's invested in that is dealing with some of the strain of being a public company. We've talked about the difficulties of IPOs and those kinds of exits. I would say that the firm that he's investing in, even like a merit, like there's still room for those firms to trade up more. Like it sounds crazy, but the firms in tens of billions of assets, these are still massive businesses worth a lot of money. But even then, it's not at the same level of like Peter Malukin Creative Planning, which got a $16 billion enterprise valuation.
Yeah. So basically, no, Alex, wrong connection to make, plenty of room to grow. He's going to be just fine.
I think that they'll be fine.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, look, unless you had anything else to add on that, I wanted to kind of move to our last point of the day, which is looking ahead to next week and the Charles Schwab Impact Conference, which, Ian, you have described as the sort of the Super Bowl of the RIA industry.
It's the Super Bowl for getting scoops.
Super Bowl for getting scoops. Okay. Well, look, so brilliant. So we'll next week we'll probably record. Well, you're both going down.
It's in Denver,
Colorado this year.
Yes.
Thousands upon thousands of advisors expected to attend, plus all the attendant industry folk, vendors from sort of, you know, the tech folk, other custodians, and asset managers, everything there.
I'm proud to say, hopefully Chris Telhund is listening to this, that I booked my conference hotel walking distance from the convention center in budget.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Months in advance.
There you go. Look at that. Yeah, that's definitely the key information that people have tuned in for. So leaving that aside, Ian, what can we expect from this year's conference? What are you looking forward to? Beyond sort of scoops, I suppose, what do you get out of it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see. I think that John Beattie, we'll have a chance to talk to him, which I'm very excited for. That'll be a good interview. I'm curious to see kind of how he talks about the Schwab Referral Network, which we've broken stories about before.
Sam broke the story.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's yes. You broke the story on them raising the fees for those referrals. Yes. And then Sam, you broke the story more recently on them raising the threshold for you know, how big a client has to be to be referred out to that network. Yep. And you were sadly ill, so couldn't take your victory lap on the pod with us.
Yes.
Whenever that was, about a month ago or less. Okay, so yeah, but as we talked about then, there's a sort of a little bit of a tension there perhaps around that network and then pulling the ladder up a little bit.
And that tension's always been there, but I'm curious to see to what extent they kind of address some of those changes, either on stage in the general session or in smaller group conversations with reporters like myself, Sam, Alec, and other outlets like Wealth Management that'll be there too.
Cool. Okay, so that'd be interesting. Anything else that you're looking forward to, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking to Kayla Culver. She's a executive at Schwab, like big on the risk and supervision end. Looking forward to that, and you know, talking to other RIA industry execs and things like that will be really, really great.
Great sort of time and place to touch base with the broader industry, find out how, you know, RIAs are doing, I guess, you know, coming off the back of 2025 and kind of what things are looking like for next year. Ian, anything more to add on that?
Yeah, no, I also think there's a lot of prominent CEOs that'll be there too, which I'm excited to see. I think Fielding Miller will be there from CapTrust, Jeff Decco from Wealth Enhancement. Yeah, we have a whole bunch of panels that we're going to be going to, which I'm excited about as well. Not only deal making, which I feel like we talk about a lot, but also a lot of stuff on regulation, practice management. I mean, yep. There really is something for everyone at this conference.
Fantastic. Well, look, I think, next week I imagine we're going to do something where we speak to the both of you from Denver on the ground. So we'll have a sort of, an update for those of you listening who don't make it. We'll do our best to bring it to you in audio format, probably from Ian's conveniently placed and very well priced hotel room. Excellent. Well, look, I think on that note, we'll call time on today's episode. So Ian and Sam, thank you both very much indeed for joining me. Listener, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.